The Eyes of Vampire Geneticist Matthew Claremont, a discovery of witches introduces us to his laboratory, a private and secure research facility connected to the University of Oxford that works with ancient DNA to study species evolution and extinction. The lab is state of the science in its equipment, computer capabilities, and reputation. Matthew is a well-respected scientist, but he prefers to work in solitude and publish his findings only occasionally in the most scholarly publications. A vampire's long life suits the prolonged, solitary study required for scientific research, and Matthew's present research lab is the culmination of 1,500 years of learning. With society, beliefs, and discoveries ever-changing over time, Matthew's ideas have of course altered dramatically. But there have always been common threads: an interest in the diversity of nature, in the structure and function of the human body, and in health, medicine, and epidemiology. The key to understanding the influences that have shaped the vampire Matthew, like everything in the All Souls world, lies in a story of books. What would have been Matthew's favorite scientific books over the centuries? Just as historians study what was once John Dee's vast library to piece together his thoughts and influences, so too we can take a trip through the centuries of Matthew's study and track the evolution of Matthew de Clermont, the scientist. The evolution of Matthew de Clermont, his library of scientific works through the ages. 500 to 999. During the early period of Matthew's life as a vampire, he would have had very little access to scientific and medical texts outside of those few books about natural history and medicine that Isabeau, Philippe, Baldwin, and Hugh de Clermont owned from the classical period. Pliny the Elder, Natural History, AD 77. Pliny the Elder, AD 23 to 79, was a soldier and commander in the Roman military and a public servant under Emperor Vespasian. He was also a prolific writer who researched and wrote books at night after working during the day for the Roman Empire. Indeed, Pliny is said to have spent every spare moment engaged in research or writing, except when asleep or fully immersed in his bath. This allowed him to write a wide variety of books over the course of his life, including histories, grammars, and even a military work on the throwing of the javelin from horseback, one of Philippe's favorites. Today he is remembered chiefly for his magnificent and encyclopedic Natural History. This was Pliny's attempt to bring extensive, exhaustive research about the natural world together with his personal observations to give an understanding of the nature of things, that is, life. Pliny began his Natural History in AD 77. His work on it ended with his death in AD 79 as a result of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. After the initial eruption, he sailed to investigate the calamity and rescue a friend, as well as others on the island. But his ship was trapped in the harbor by winds, and all perished. His nephew, Pliny the Younger, published Natural History for him posthumously, with little revision. Natural History consists of 37 books, or sections, arranged roughly into the Aristotelian categories of animal, vegetable, and mineral, with subjects ordered by analogies and shared qualities, as well as the opposite, contrasting qualities. This lends Natural History a meandering but engaging narrative flow. Topics range widely from astronomy to geography, zoology to botany, water to magic to mining. There are books on geography, Spain, regions of Italy, alpine nations, the cities of Egypt, on trees, fruit, forest, and otherwise cultivated ones, on stones, marble, geodes, the Sphinx, on animals, the habits of lions, the taming of elephants, and reports of dragons in Ethiopia, and on remedies derived from living creatures, plants, and aquatic animals. The flesh of the sea tortoise mixed with that of frogs is an excellent remedy for injuries caused by the salamander. Pliny also makes a wide study of humanity and anthropology, including a chapter devoted to monstrous births, and even a chapter on persons who have come to life again after being laid out for burial. This recounts incidents of men and women being revived by flames and other operations of nature. These were not, as Pliny takes pains to point out, examples of miracles. Natural History is notable not only for its breadth and depth, but also for Pliny's extensive citation and commentary on his sources, which pointed his readers to hundreds of Roman and Greek authors and their bodies of knowledge. It is impossible to overstate Pliny's importance in shaping Matthew's worldview. Pliny's wide-ranging encyclopedic approach would have opened Matthew's eyes to the marvelous variety of nature, to its mysteries, and to the hidden connections between geographic regions, flora and fauna, and the human and the divine. Even today, Pliny reads as a combination of science and fairy tale, and that combination would have appealed to Matthew's imagination, important for all creatures, but especially scientists, as well as his intellect. At the same time, Matthew would probably have found much to argue with in Pliny's dismissal of miracles. As a Christian, which Pliny was not, Matthew would have been raised to see the hand of God in every aspect of creation, and to interpret some wonders as divine messages of approbation or censure. While reading Pliny, Matthew would have drawn lines between science and his own faith. Over the course of his long life, Matthew has shifted that line many, many times. Today, we often look down on encyclopedic knowledge, devaluing it as an unoriginal contribution to knowledge. This does a disservice to the encyclopedic genre. We all need reference books and compendiums of knowledge. The crucial point is that an encyclopedia is your first resort, not your final one. As in Matthew's case, an encyclopedic treatment of a subject is an excellent foundation, but it is only a first step toward mastery. Galen, Works, AD 219. Galen, AD 129, circa 200 to 219. Was a Greek physician and philosopher renowned for his contributions to the scientific study of anatomy and physiology. As a young man, Galen received a philosophical and medical education, including study at the medical school in Alexandria, and he went on to become physician to the gladiators of the high priest of Asia. The wounds of those gladiators functioned, in his words, as windows into the body. Eventually, he served as physician to several Roman emperors, while at the same time continuing to treat and perform surgeries on patients. He also undertook his own investigations into the systems of the body, but was hampered by Roman laws that forbade autopsies and the dissection of human bodies. Galen believed, however, that there were significant similarities between human anatomy and that of animals. He performed numerous dissections on living and dead animals, including apes, monkeys, dogs, and pigs. These dissections and vivisections allowed him to offer new insights into animal and human physiology. For instance, Galen showed that the voice is produced by the larynx, inflated pig's lungs with bellows, proved that both arteries and veins moved blood through the body, and distinguished arterial blood from venous blood. He placed particular importance on a person's pulse, monitoring it for irregularities to help diagnose illness, a practice still used by doctors today. Though his conclusions contained many errors, for example that blood was generated in the liver, Galen's observations and experiments helped shape new and more accurate understandings about the human nervous system, the respiratory system, and, perhaps most notably, the circulatory system. A core medical theory of the ancient world, which thanks to Galen became ingrained in Western medical practice for centuries, was that of the four humors in the human body. These were believed to exist as four fluids, each with corresponding temperaments: blood, sanguine; yellow bile, choleric; black bile, melancholic; and phlegm, phlegmatic. As Galen emphasized in his treatise on temperaments, good health relied on the optimum balance of these four humors in the body. The distribution of each in a person could determine that individual's sensitivity to certain diseases. The practice of bloodletting came from a desire to rebalance the bodily fluids and release excess blood. The four humors also corresponded to mixtures of hot, dry, cold, and wet, as well as the core elements earth, air, fire, and water, and the seasons spring, summer, autumn, and winter. As Galen accumulated skill and knowledge, he dictated his findings to scribes. Historians believe that by the end of his life, he had authored as many as 500 treatises, though only about a third of these have survived. Even so, Galen is among the most prolific writers in antiquity. At a time when many Roman physicians relied on divination and prophecy to make diagnoses, Galen's emphasis on empiricism helped transform Western medicine. He became the established authority for European medieval medical students until challenges to his theories emerged in the 16th century. As with Pliny, it is impossible to overstate Galen's influence on Matthew. Galen's anatomy, physiology, and therapeutics would have shaped the first millennium of Matthew's experiences as a patient and doctor. Once he had learned to read, Matthew would have read everything that Galen wrote multiple times. As a vampire, Matthew would have been particularly fascinated by Galen's anatomy and physiology. After all, not even Matthew could see beneath a creature's skin. Galen's vivid imagery would have helped Matthew imagine the structures and functions of the human body. Galen likened the aorta, for instance, to a trunk divided into many branches and twigs that nourish the whole body. And in his treatise on the use of the pulse in diagnosis, Galen provided descriptions of 27 distinct types of pulse for Matthew to observe. More important, Galen's treatise, Is Blood Naturally Contained in the Arteries?, would have given Matthew an explanation for why, when an artery is first cut, there is no sign of blood, but only air. The answer, for Galen, was that the arteries carried both blood and pneuma, spirit, while the veins carried only corporeal blood. Such a theory would have given Matthew a framework for understanding why, for instance, he was able to see people's thoughts when he drank their blood. Galen's work on the elements and bodily humors would have provided Matthew with an explanation for his blood rage, that he had an excess of choleric humor, as well as a way to cope with his dark moods, that he was prone to a melancholic humor. Galen's theory of the four humors would also have served as Matthew's template when diagnosing his first patients. Pedanius Dioscorides, De Materia Medica, AD 50-70. Pedanius Dioscorides, circa AD 40-90, the author of De Materia Medica, served as a physician in the Roman army. In that position, he traveled extensively throughout southeastern Europe, and everywhere he went, he sought out the medicinal uses of local plants and animals, and their preparation and applications, which he recorded and added to his professional repertoire of medical treatment. Eventually, Dioscorides compiled his findings in a 5-volume book in Greek, which was translated into many languages and is probably best known by its Latin title, De Materia Medica. De Materia Medica includes information on nearly 600 plants, as well as some 80 animals or animal parts, and almost 100 minerals. Dioscorides provides his readers with approximately 1,000 medicines derived from these. The 5 volumes are arranged such that medicinal plants appear first, then animal parts, roots, seeds, and juices, then primarily culinary herbs, and finally wines and minerals. Within each volume, the various plants, animals, and minerals are arranged in a grouping with others that have similar medicinal effects, rather than alphabetically or geographically, to aid the physician healer. Most surviving manuscripts and later printed editions of the text are heavily illustrated so that plants could be more easily identified. His pharmacopoeia ranged from copper to colocynth, nursing mother's milk to vipers, pomegranate root bark to opium poppies, with preparations for treating everything from toothaches to madness. De Materia Medica marked an important shift from thinking about the natural world as a place of fantastic wonders to seeing it as an environment full of natural substances and creatures possessed of significant healing properties. The book remained in continual use by physicians and healers throughout the Mediterranean, North Africa, and Europe, until well into the 16th century. In fact, its success and wide distribution meant that the plants defined in the book were often not native to a specific area, so physicians and healers would sometimes substitute native plants that resembled those Dioscorides described, with predictably disastrous results. The European discovery of the Americas put particular stress on the authority of Dioscorides' catalog of plants and their uses. Still, his pharmacological contributions proved to be of lasting medical value. Medical preparations of many of these same plants, such as willow bark, salicylic acid, and opium poppy, morphine, remain in use today for the same purposes that Dioscorides recommended. In many ways, Dioscorides' work is an encyclopedia of plants. He and the Roman encyclopedist Pliny were contemporaries, and Dioscorides' influence on Matthew is similar to that of Pliny's. From Dioscorides, Matthew would have received his foundational knowledge of plants and their medicinal properties. He would have used his copy of Dioscorides whenever recommending a medicine or a treatment to his patients. Matthew would also have made his own investigations into his native mountains, looking for plants mentioned in Dioscorides and similar substitutes. There is no doubt that there is at least one heavily annotated copy of Dioscorides De Materia Medica in Matthew's libraries, perhaps including notes on his experiences with the various plants and medicines. 1000 to 1500. In this period, Matthew would have enjoyed formal training in medicine at the medical schools in Spain, Constantinople, Salerno, and other universities. His Latin, Greek, and Arabic would have been sufficiently strong that he could read, write, and converse in those tongues with knowledgeable practitioners. He would also have dealt with the complicated philosophy of Aristotle, which Philippe would have shared with him for centuries, and had his first encounter with learned theories of contagion and disease, thanks to the famous physician, Razis. It's important to remember that Matthew spent as much time as a soldier as he did a scholar in the Middle Ages. As a result, his opportunities for study and the practice of medicine, other than emergency medicine on the battlefield, would have been limited. In addition, ancient figures like Pliny, Galen, and Dioscorides remained authoritative, and the rediscovery of other ancient philosophers, such as Aristotle, only magnified the medieval sense that the thinkers of antiquity were the ones to study and emulate. Aristotle, Metaphysics. Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, a student of Plato who went on to serve as tutor to Alexander the Great, eventually established his own school, the Lyceum, in Athens. A philosopher and scientist, Aristotle founded the field of formal logic and made the first known study of zoology. His Metaphysics is a collection of treatises that were probably written as lectures for the students at his Lyceum, which may account for the fact that they are sometimes vague on certain points, and seem to be arranged somewhat unpredictably. In these treatises, Aristotle describes metaphysics as the first philosophy, which he defines as the study of things that are subject to the laws of nature. In metaphysics, he wrestles with questions like, what is the nature of a plant or animal? And age-old existential questions like, what is being? Aristotle was an empiricist, and although he lacked many of the modern tools of measurement, he argued that answers to questions such as these must not be simply perceptual, but must be supported with facts and causes. In his Metaphysics, Aristotle reconciled two competing beliefs that then prevailed regarding the nature of the world. The first was that all things are constantly changing, and the other was the belief that reason tells us that the world is unchanging and is composed of one single reality. Aristotle explained that all things around us are composed of form and matter, and that the matter is unchanging, but the form of matter constantly changes. So what makes a person is his or her basic essence that endures through changes, changes wrought by age, shifting abilities, and even death. Aristotle taught that the essence of someone or something is its primary unalterable substance. The form of a living creature, a vegetable, or a thing changes constantly, but without altering this essence. Aristotle's Metaphysics was one of scores of ancient texts that were lost to the Christian West, though known to Arabic philosophers, because Western scholars lacked the knowledge of Greek and access to Greek texts that would have been necessary to read the work. Though Matthew could read and write Greek, there were few people to discuss the ideas with except for Hugh, Fernando, and Philippe. Once the Metaphysics came back into Western European hands in the 12th century, however, the book would have been discussed and its ideas debated at the universities. Most of Matthew's university friends would have been reading Latin translations made from Arabic translations of a Greek text. It was not until the 13th century, after the Fourth Crusade, that a non-vampiric Western European encountered an original Greek text. Matthew would have been intrigued by the notion that something essential in a person endured even though other qualities changed. The idea would have provided solace to him at a time when he was questioning his faith, his role in the family, and his purpose in life. It is probably due to the influence of Aristotle that Matthew was able to formulate his guiding question, "Who am I, and why am I here?" Muhammad ibn Zakaria al-Razi, Razis, A Treatise on Smallpox and Measles. Muhammad ibn Zakaria al-Razi, 865 to circa 925, was a celebrated Islamic scholar and physician known in Western Europe as Razis. Al-Razi moved to Baghdad when he was young and became physician to the royal court, as well as the director of a large hospital. The experience and observations from his work there underpinned his medical writings. Like most of his contemporary scholars, he was influenced by ancient Greek medicine and produced hundreds of medical and scientific works that were widely translated and studied in both the Islamic and European spheres. Among al-Razi's large scholarly output, his most significant work was A Treatise on Smallpox and Measles. Written at the end of the 9th century, this was the first comprehensive examination of smallpox. Al-Razi noted that while Galen mentioned the disease, he didn't offer any help in understanding its causes or finding its cure. In al-Razi's classic treatise of differential diagnosis, he laid out detailed clinical descriptions of the symptoms and treatment for smallpox and the danger of contagion. He also distinguished these symptoms from measles through careful examination of his patients and the nature of the diseases. He attracted many students during his lifetime, and after his death, his fame gradually spread into medieval Europe. Latin translations of his work and his other medical works influenced European medical education and practitioners. Matthew would not have needed to wait for a Latin translation of al-Razi's work. He would have read it in Arabic while he was living and working in the city of Cordoba, shortly after al-Razi's death. It was in Cordoba that Matthew received his first formal training as a physician, and smallpox had been brought to the Iberian Peninsula in the 7th century Arab conquest. He would have treated smallpox victims and seen the lasting disfigurement that often afflicted survivors. Most important, the work of al-Razi gave Matthew a set of symptoms so that he could diagnose, isolate, and treat patients with the disease. Smallpox was a significant medical threat due to its highly contagious profile and high mortality rate. Al-Razi's work provided Matthew with the theory of acquired immunity, a subject that interests Matthew to the present day. Someone who contracts smallpox and survives cannot contract the disease again. Matthew would have wondered if having smallpox was somehow analogous to being a vampire. Was vampirism a disease, like smallpox, that gave you a kind of total immunity to other diseases? It was not a question Matthew could answer at the time, but it was the work of al-Razi, along with Matthew's own experiences in hospitals and at patient bedsides, that helped him to frame it. Ibn Sina, Avicenna, The Book of Healing, before 1037, The Canon of Medicine, before 1037. After the breakup of the Roman Empire and the spread of Islam from the 7th century, a period known as the Islamic Golden Age saw a blossoming of Arabic culture, science, and scholarship in the Middle East, largely radiating from Baghdad. Many classical works were gathered and translated there from Greek, Egyptian, Roman, Chinese, and Indian authors. This provided a rich array of source material for Arab scholars and influenced their work. Their efforts ensured that key texts from the ancient world, like Aristotle's Metaphysics, which might otherwise have been lost, were in turn translated from Arabic into Hebrew and Latin, to be rediscovered by the scholars of medieval Western Europe. Ibn Sina, circa 980 to 1037, or Avicenna, as he was known in Europe, was a Persian philosopher and physician, and is celebrated as one of the greatest Islamic scholars of this golden age. He was born near Bukhara, a city now in Uzbekistan, and died in Hamadan, Iran. Ibn Sina's studies encompassed the classical authors available in the libraries of Bukhara, and he turned to medicine at the age of 16. His works covered a range of subjects, but it was with the Book of Healing and the Canon of Medicine that he had the most widespread and lasting influence. The Book of Healing, also known as The Cure, is a sprawling, encyclopedic work of philosophy and science. It is divided into four sections under the subjects of logic, physics, mathematics, and metaphysics, with each topic then split into relevant subsections. Ibn Sina drew on the models of the ancient authors he had studied, in particular Aristotle and his metaphysics, continuing their ideas while using them to put forward his own theories about the nature of existence. This book established Ibn Sina as one of the leading philosophers in the Arab world, and later, with the Latin translation, influential among European intellectuals. The Canon of Medicine was similarly translated into Latin in the 12th century and became a core text for medieval European medical students. They dubbed Ibn Sina, along with Galen, Princeps Medicorum, Prince of Physicians. The canon is clearly categorized and structured into five books covering all aspects of medical theory and practice. Drawing on the earlier work of Galen, beginning with general discussions of the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and building on Galen's system of the four humors, The five books are themselves then subdivided and include examinations of anatomy, diseases, and their treatments, as well as the nature and use of simple and compound drugs. Ibn Sina emphasized the importance of experience and practice alongside theory, with clinical trials an important part of his acquired knowledge in the potency of specific remedies. Ibn Sina's The Canon was a textbook rather than an encyclopedia, and his purpose was to write for teachers and students of medicine. In the first chapter, he carefully distinguished what medicine was and what it was not. For Matthew, Ibn Sina's efforts to explain the relationship between the practice of medicine and its underlying theoretical base opened whole new avenues to explore. While medicine was devoted to the practical understanding and treatment of the human body, for example, natural philosophy dealt with questions such as, what is a humor? What are the four elements? But the practice clearly rested on these theoretical foundations, and once that was set out for Matthew, he wanted to contribute to both aspects of medical science. In some ways, his life as a geneticist and a molecular biologist can be dated back to Ibn Sina. Matthew's first serious study of natural philosophy as a body of knowledge was undertaken through Ibn Sina's The Book of Healing. In spite of its title, The Book of Healing was Ibn Sina's encyclopedic effort to cure an ignorant soul. Matthew's first systematic exposure to chemistry, astronomy, and logic was possible because of this foundational text. Of particular importance to Matthew's development as a scientist was Ibn Sina's rejection of Aristotle's method of induction, moving from particular instances to more generalized statements, in favor of examination and experimentation. Because Matthew is a fluent Arabic writer and speaker, he first read Ibn Sina in Arabic, as he did Al-Razi. Matthew's brother Hugh gave him copies of both the Canon and the Book of Healing, which he values among his prized possessions. 1500 to 1700. These were the centuries when everything changed for Matthew. Known by historians as the period of the scientific revolution, this was a time when old systems of knowledge were crumbling. Chemistry, medicine, anatomy, and physiology all underwent fundamental transformations. Matthew would have been especially interested in the dissections of Vesalius, the idea that the heart was a pump, Harvey, and the toxicology of Paracelsus, particularly his ideas about poisons and biochemistry. He also would have loved microscopy. Paracelsus, Das Buch Peregrinum, 1529-30, and On the Causes of Invisible Diseases, after 1531. Paracelsus, 1493-1541, was a controversial figure in the history of science in the early 16th century. His real name was Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, and he was born in Switzerland, the son of a Swiss physician. Taught medicine by his father, Paracelsus later studied in Italy and traveled extensively as a military physician for the Venetian army. He gathered and recorded valuable observations from the people he met and treated. He fiercely rejected many of the old established medical texts and stirred outrage by publicly burning the books of Galen and Ibn Sina. Paracelsus instead promoted practice and experience as the only true tutor. The patients are your textbook, the sickbed your study. Alongside this, his interest in alchemy and the occult and the credit he gave to time-tested folk medicines and beliefs were both equally important to his medical experimentation. Paracelsus has been hailed as the father of toxicology, as well as the father of modern pharmacology, for his pioneering work to bring chemistry into medicine. He argued against Galen's commonly accepted system of the four humors, blood, phlegm, yellow and black bile, in the body, and instead put forward the principle of three vital substances, salt, representing stability, sulfur, representing combustibility, and mercury, liquidity. Not only did Paracelsus' theories influence medicine, they were heavily debated among alchemists. He believed that the cure for a disease could be determined by deciphering which of these three core elements was the cause, and that a poison in the body would be cured by a similar poison, as long as it was administered in the correct dosage. He alleged that all things could be poisonous in large quantities, and that correspondingly otherwise harmful substances could be a cure in the right doses. Like Galen, Paracelsus wrote many works over the course of his lifetime, but only a handful were published. After his death, students and other followers gathered up notes, manuscripts, and recollections, and published them in Latin editions as well as in German so that they could reach a wide audience. The popularity of Paracelsus's work throughout Western Europe can be seen by the numerous vernacular translations that were undertaken in the 16th and 17th centuries. Matthew was familiar with Paracelsus and his work. Though Matthew found Paracelsus's personality abrasive and disagreed with his bombastic style, he was intrigued by the man's ideas. Two works that were of particular influence were his Peregrinum and On the Causes of Invisible Diseases. In the Peregrinum, Paracelsus argued that medicine should be based on four pillars: natural philosophy, to better understand the plant and animal kingdoms; astronomy, to better understand the relationship between humanity and the divine influences; alchemy, to better understand the mineral kingdom; and virtue, the power of the practitioner and patient to influence a medical cure. The Peregrinum emphasized the sympathetic links that existed between widely separated parts of the world system. This system of correspondences, as it was known in the early modern period, helped Matthew develop his ideas about the links between seemingly different creatures. In On the Causes of Invisible Diseases, Paracelsus considered other topics of interest to Matthew: the role of the imagination in disease, and the place of faith in healing. At a time when science and medicine were moving away from religion, Paracelsus put forward the role of unseen factors in the mind and spirit that could influence the body. On the Causes of Invisible Disease also contains information about magic and the roles that charms, talismans, and other magical practices might play in medicine and health. Drawing on his idea of correspondences, Paracelsus built magic into every aspect of his philosophical system, which might explain Matthew's insistence to Diana that science and magic are more closely aligned than she believes. Andreas Vesalius, De Fabrica Humani Corporis, 1543. The well-worn copy of Andreas Vesalius's book that Diana found on Matthew's shelves was clearly a favorite of his. First published in 1543, it marked a crucial turning point in the history of medicine. Vesalius, born in Brussels, was a physician in the 16th century, 1514 to 64. He described how he first went about studying human bones from the Cemetery of the Innocents in Paris when he was a medical student there. Soon after, his remarkable talent for dissection became clear. Traveling to Italy, Vesalius was appointed to teach anatomy and surgery at Padua University, and later went on to become imperial physician to Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, to whom the book is dedicated. De Fabrica was based on Vesalius's lectures and dissections at Padua, and is arranged into sections on bones and cartilages, ligaments and muscles, organs of nutrition and generation, the heart and associated organs, and the brain. His aim was to provide as truthful and complete an account as possible of the fabric of the human body, which is made not of 10 or 12 different parts, as it seems to the casual observer, but of some thousand. He highlighted where Galen's anatomical ideas had been based on a dissection of animals rather than on human corpses. Although some of Galen's ideas remained, most notably the theory of the four bodily humors. Vesalius was famous in his time for breaking with traditional teaching methods and dissecting human corpses himself in front of the students, rather than leaving it to a surgeon who was viewed as someone with only manual skill. He also used visual aids to illustrate clearly the specific anatomy he was explaining. The visual representations of dissections in De Fabrica and the beautiful, intricate detail of the woodcut illustrations contributed to the book's importance. Vesalius noted that our pictures of the parts of the body will give particular pleasure to those people who do not always have the opportunity of dissecting a human body, bringing clarity and accessibility to a subject that had previously been so obscure. One of the surviving copies of the book, held in Brown University's John Hay Library, is bound in human skin. Matthew, a veteran of battlefields and hospitals, had suspected for some time that Galen's anatomy was not quite right. But it took Vesalius's dissections and the publication and discussion of his findings to get Matthew to begin to move away from the Galenic texts that had informed his first 1,000 years. Matthew was one of the many spectators who attended Vesalius's dissections in Padua in the early 1540s. Though some were there for the spectacle, Matthew was there to learn as much as he could about the body's secrets. He befriended Vesalius and remained in contact with the anatomist long after he left the city of Venice in 1543. Having read Vesalius and observed his dissections, Matthew became even more convinced that the human body was a marvelous example of God's creative ingenuity. At the same time, he began to appreciate, as never before, that the body was knowable, and that a better understanding of its many mysteries was possible. Thenceforth, he took advantage of every chance he got to study the body's structure and its function. From the diagnosis of the pulse, to treating a wounded soldier, to working in a hospital ward, Matthew began to advance his own ideas in a series of anatomical notebooks and medical notes that remained scattered throughout his libraries. William Harvey, De Mortu Cordis, 1628. Next to Vesalius's seminal work on human anatomy, Diana found another well-thumbed favorite on Matthew's shelf, William Harvey's De Mortu Cordis. Matthew later revealed how he had come to know the 17th century physiologist. William Harvey, 1578 to 1657, was born in the south of England. He studied medicine at the University of Padua, then returned to his home country and joined the College of Physicians in London at the age of 26. He became renowned in his lifetime for his experiments and discoveries about the workings of the heart, laying out the mechanics of how it pumped blood in a closed circuit around the body. He published his findings in the 1628 landmark work, De Mortu Cordis, or An Anatomical Exercise on the Motion of the Heart and the Blood in Living Beings. He dedicated the book to the most illustrious and indomitable Prince Charles, King of Great Britain, and opened it with, "The heart of animals is the foundation of life, the sovereign of everything within them, the sun of their microcosm, that upon which all growth depends, from which all power proceeds." It made a huge impact on his contemporaries. De Mortu Cordis has been seen as an important work in the history of science in the West, not only for Harvey's groundbreaking discoveries, which disproved old theories, such as Galen's idea that venous blood was produced in the liver, but also for his methodology and detailed systematic approach. Harvey based his work on vigorous experimentation and clear empirical evidence. Like Vesalius, he questioned the revered authorities such as Galen and Aristotle when their teaching did not hold up against his own experience. He was careful to show that he had spent years proving his findings, not contradicting these ancient scientists arrogantly, but from dissections and from the fabric of nature. What Vesalius did for Matthew's understanding of anatomy, Harvey did for his understanding of physiology. Though Matthew worried that there was little room in Harvey's heart for the operation of the spirit or soul, he couldn't fail to be convinced by the physician's careful evidence and demonstrations. Even with his worries over how these new findings might challenge his faith, Matthew continued to wonder at God's creative ingenuity. If anatomical structure had shown God at his sculptural best, then the new physiology of Harvey and his contemporaries showed the creator as a mechanic as well as an artist, fashioning in the heart a vital engine of life. Moreover, while vampire anatomy did not differ from human anatomy, vampire physiology offered important contrasts for Matthew to consider. He had noticed that a vampire pulse was far slower than a human pulse. He'd tried to fit that observation into Galenic theory for centuries, wondering if vampires had a different amount of vital pneuma or spirit in the blood, or if they lacked some of the bodily humors that humans struggle to keep in balance. With Harvey, Matthew began to wonder if a vampire's slower heartbeat meant that the pump of the heart was slower to wear out, leading to a longer lifespan. Robert Hooke, Micrographia, 1665. Robert Hooke is not well known today, possibly because he had so many intellectual interests he scarcely had time to develop them all. Hooke was born on the Isle of Wight in 1635 and studied at Oxford in the 1650s. There he served for 7 years as the assistant to the famous Robert Boyle, the scientist who discovered that the volume of a gas decreases with increasing pressure and vice versa. After his employ by Boyle, London's Royal Society appointed Hooke curator of experiments in 1661. His own experiments in observing objects under the microscope, still a relatively new instrument at that time, were the basis for micrographia, small drawings, in 1665. Though others, for example Antonie van Leeuwenhoek, had worked to develop microscopy, Hooke was the first to capitalize on the uses of print technology to share these developments with a wide audience. Micrographia was a revelation to its readers and soon became a bestseller. Hooke described his observations under the microscope of a wide variety of common objects and creatures. The point of a needle, sand, sponges, kidney stones, mold, the eye of a fly, his own hair, and invited the reader into this tiny world through detailed illustrations. His conclusions were also groundbreaking. Based on his examination of cork, Hooke was the first to use the word cell to describe the units that composed larger organisms. He suggested the wave theory of light. Possibly most important for Mathieu de Clermont, Hooke deduced that fossils had once been living creatures. The prevailing theory at the time was that fossils were formed within the earth, that they were not the remains of living beings, but were created by an extraordinary plastic virtue. But Hooke wrote, "I cannot but think that all these, and most other kinds of stony bodies which are found thus strangely figured, do owe their formation and figuration not to any kind of plastic virtue inherent in the earth, but to the shells of certain shellfishes, which, either by some deluge, inundation, earthquake, or some other such means, came to be thrown to that place, and there to be filled with some kind of mud or clay. That these shells and many, from the particular nature of the containing or enclosed earth, or some other cause, have in tract of time rotted and moldered away, and only left their impressions." Hooke believed not only that fossils were the remains of living beings, but also that those beings could become extinct. This made Hooke one of the first proponents of a theory of evolution. Like many scientists, Hooke was ambitious and became incensed when he didn't receive appropriate recognition for his work. He famously quarreled with Isaac Newton over the attribution of his ideas, and Newton retaliated by minimizing Hooke's achievements. Hooke also contested Christian Huygens's claim to have invented the balance spring watch in 1675. Hooke was irate because he had shown his own version of this watch to the Royal Society 5 years earlier, but the official minutes did not record the event. In a turn of plot worthy of the All Souls trilogy, a long-lost 17th-century manuscript has laid this controversy to rest. In 2006, a manuscript was discovered in a cupboard in England containing Hooke's personal copies of minutes of the Royal Society meetings from 1661 to 1691. This not only confirmed Hooke's claim, but also provided a trove of information that shed new light on his scientific contributions. 1700 to 1800. As he had been in the medieval period, Matthew was largely a soldier and a politician during this century, although he kept up to date with developments in medicine and surgery. Edward Jenner's discoveries would have opened up whole new possibilities for thinking about health and healing, and Matthew would also have had an interest in the work of John Hunter. John Hunter. Observations tending to show that the wolf, jackal, and dog are all of the same species. Philosophical Transactions, 1787. Born the youngest of 10 children to a Scottish family in 1728, John Hunter initially had little interest in formal education. At the age of 20, however, he paid a visit to his brother William, a distinguished teacher of anatomy in London, and found his true vocation. John joined his brother as an assistant and showed enormous talent for dissection, helping William procure corpses for dissection at a time when physicians had limited access to cadavers. Later, Hunter formally studied surgery and anatomy and qualified as a surgeon, setting up his own surgical practice in 1764. Like Paracelsus, Hunter believed that the study of nature was essential to developing a doctor's observational skills, and he emphasized the relationship between structure and function in all living creatures. During his stint as an army staff surgeon in France and Portugal, he collected specimens of various animals. Back in London, he stalked the grounds of his house near Earl's Court with a menagerie of animals, including zebras, goats, and jackals. There he studied their anatomy and conducted other experiments. In 1783, he moved to a large house in Leicester Square, where he organized his collections into a teaching museum, which still exists today as the Hunterian Museum. Because Hunter also accepted delivery of human cadavers from grave robbers at the back entrance of his house, it is thought to have been the prototype for the residence of the fictitious Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. John Hunter did not make any single scientific breakthrough for which he is remembered, but nevertheless he is recognized as a founder of scientific surgery. His insistence on the importance of observation and experimentation was a powerful influence on such students as Edward Jenner, whose vaccine helped rid the world of the scourge of smallpox. Hunter once famously wrote to Jenner, "I think your solution is just, but why think? Why not try the experiment?" Matthew de Clermont would have read with interest Hunter's 1787 article, "Observations Tending to Show That the Wolf, Jackal, and Dog Are All of the Same Species." Hunter rightly observed that wolves and jackals were able to mate with dogs, and he concluded that both the wolf and the jackal are dogs. In any case, we may reckon three great varieties in this species, wolf, jackal, and dog, which again branch into their respective less obvious varieties. If the dog proves to be the wolf tamed, the jackal may probably be the dog returned to its wild state, which leads to another curious question. Whether as animals vary from climate, cultivation, or what may be called differences in mode of living, they would return to their genuine character if allowed to go wild again in the original country. Hunter's observations are in some ways the direct ancestor to Matthew's own inquiries into the behavior of wolf packs and the movement of lupine DNA between packs. Matthew also became fascinated with the border between wild and domesticated animals. He began to wonder, after reading Hunter, if vampires were humans that had reverted to wildness, living closer to their animal past as hunters and pack animals. Hunter's ideas about the variation among members of the dog family may also have sown the seed of Matthew's future hypothesis that the four different forms of hominid creature were branches of the same family. Edward Jenner, An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of the Variolae Vaccinae, 1798. When Edward Jenner, the father of immunology, was born in England in 1749, the disease of smallpox killed an estimated 400,000 Europeans each year and caused one-third of all cases of blindness. Variolation, inoculation with a small amount of live smallpox virus, was the only known method of protection, and it too could be deadly. Jenner himself was variolated while at school, in a process that involved first adopting a radical strict diet, copious bloodletting, then isolation with other variolated boys, until the disease had run its course. It was an experience he never forgot. As a young man, Jenner apprenticed to a surgeon in South Gloucestershire. Then, in 1770, he was apprenticed in surgery and anatomy under the revered surgeon John Hunter in London. Though Jenner returned to South Gloucestershire in 1773 as a family doctor and surgeon, the two remained lifelong friends. Jenner was by no means the first person to notice that cowpox seemed to be a preventative against smallpox. Between 1770 and 1791, half a dozen people in three different countries had observed that milkmaids, who often contracted cowpox from cows, tended to be spared from smallpox. Having been apprenticed to John Hunter, however, Jenner took the casual observations several steps further. He determined that there were two forms of cowpox, only one of which was effective in inoculating the patient from smallpox, and made sketches of cowpox pustules so that he and others could identify them. In 1796, he conducted his crucial experiment. A patient's milkmaid, Sarah Nelms, was infected with cowpox by her bovine charge, Blossom. Jenner took a small amount of fluid from a pustule on Sarah's hand and placed it under the skin of an 8-year-old boy. The boy suffered mild symptoms of illness about 9 days later, much less serious than variolation would cause. 7 weeks after that, Jenner variolated the boy, and the boy showed only the mild symptoms commonly shown by patients who had already been protected against smallpox. Unlike other early experiments, Jenner had done further research and then demonstrated, through established medical procedure, that cowpox inoculation protected the patient against smallpox. In 1798, he published the results of his observations and case histories in An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of the Variolae Vaccinae. Some of his conclusions were flawed, and the research method was rudimentary, but it was the first time that observation and experimentation had been used to produce a remedy to a deadly disease. By 1842, Parliament had declared it a felony to practice variolation instead of the safer vaccination. Jenner spent the rest of his life promoting vaccination to prevent smallpox infection. And the word vaccination is an homage to Jenner's achievement. In Latin, vacca means cow. He is often said to have saved more lives than any other human. It was the work of Jenner that encouraged Matthew to embark on two avenues of research he still pursues today. One focused on how a warm-blooded creature is transformed into a vampire, the other on whether there might be a cure for blood rage. When it came to making new vampires, Matthew began to wonder if there was something in vampire blood that vaccinated creatures against contracting other diseases. Like the fluid from the cowpox pustule, did some invisible property of a vampire's blood prevent sickness, aging, even death? As for blood rage, Matthew still hopes that some form of prevention or cure might be found for the deadly disease. Once, preventing smallpox was impossible. Jenner's discovery gave Matthew hope that one day his condition, too, might be completely eradicated. 1800 to 1899. This was a century of major breakthroughs in scientific thought. Darwin's theory on the evolution of species was a leap in biological science that stunned and excited European society. For Matthew, it opened boundless possibilities for understanding who he was and what his place in the world might be. Charles Darwin, On the Origin of Species, 1859. The affinities of all the beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. As buds give rise by growth to fresh buds, and these, if vigorous, branch out and overtop on all sides many a feebler branch, so by generation I believe it has been with the great tree of life, which fills with its dead and broken branches the crust of the earth, and covers the surface with its ever-branching and beautiful ramifications. Charles Darwin's groundbreaking On the Origin of Species laid out the process of change, conceived from his extensive research into natural history, that he called natural selection and the evolution of species. It caused a storm of controversy upon publication and changed the way that people in the Western world had always thought about their origins. Darwin stripped away the role of God in creation, introducing his contemporaries to the idea of nature's survival of the fittest, with the gradual adaptation over time of plants and animals through struggle and reproduction. Born in England, Darwin, 1809 to 1882, had started out at Edinburgh University studying medicine, but after a year he turned to natural history and went on to focus on his passion at Cambridge University. In 1831, he joined the expedition of the HMS Beagle as a naturalist and geologist. A five-year trip that took him to South America and the Galapagos Islands, among others. From this trip's meticulously recorded observations of plant and animal species and of fossils, as well as his studies in the countryside of England when he returned, Darwin gradually formulated the framework of his theory of natural selection. It would be more than 20 years before he published his work. By 1859, Darwin wasn't the only one whose research led him to these hypotheses. He noted at the beginning of Origin that the naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace had also come to the same conclusions about evolution, and that this had precipitated the swift publication of his own book. The way in which Darwin brought together his vast array of evidence, the engaging and carefully crafted narrative of the book, and his coining of the phrase natural selection instantly captured a huge readership and brought his hypotheses into the mainstream. As Diana read through Matthew's signed first edition of On the Origin of Species at Septour, she saw how Darwin's ideas had excited the 19th century Matthew. It was the combination of Hunter's work on the dog family and Darwin's later work on natural selection that framed Matthew's own research into creature origins. The history of creatures in the All Souls world illuminates Darwin's theory that it is the ability to change and adapt above all that determines a species' survival. 1900 to 1999. This century was all about biochemistry for Matthew, and it marked an exciting time for his research in genetics. Alexander Fleming, On the Antibacterial Action of Cultures of a Penicillium, with special reference to their use in the isolation of B. influenzae. British Journal of Experimental Pathology, 10, 226 to 236, 1929. The Scot, Alexander Fleming, graduated from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London in 1906 at the age of 25, and later joined the research department there, becoming an assistant to a bacteriologist. After taking a degree in bacteriology in 1908, he remained at St. Mary's as a lecturer until the Great War broke out in 1914. Fleming developed his interest in finding an effective antibacterial while working in France as a member of the Royal Army Medical Corps. Many soldiers died of sepsis resulting from infected wounds. Fleming discovered that the antiseptics used for wounds might have done more harm than good, because they killed beneficial agents on the surface and did nothing to kill anaerobic bacteria deep inside the wound. After the war ended, he continued his search for antibacterial substances. As most schoolchildren know, Fleming's discovery of penicillin was not only accidental, but was the direct result of his reluctance to clean his laboratory. In September 1928, he returned from vacation to find dirty petri dishes stacked in a corner. One culture had been contaminated by a fungus, and the colonies of bacteria immediately surrounding the fungus were dead. Fleming immediately set about growing the mold in a pure culture and found that it killed many different disease-causing bacteria. With help from his mycologist colleague, Old Moldy, whose lab might have been the source of the rogue fungus, he identified it as Penicillium chrysogenum. Actually, Old Moldy initially misidentified it, but Fleming was gracious about the mistake. After several months of calling the resulting substance mold juice, Fleming settled on the more salutary name of penicillin. When Fleming published his discovery in the British Journal of Experimental Pathology in 1929, it aroused little interest. Fleming, unlike Darwin, was a notoriously poor communicator. He couldn't cultivate enough penicillin for it to be useful on a larger scale, and he couldn't persuade a chemist to help him solve the problem. We now know that penicillin is produced only by certain species of penicillium, and only when the growth of the fungus is inhibited by stress, a complicated combination of factors. Fleming had all but abandoned his efforts by 1938, when Howard Florey, a pharmacologist and pathologist at Oxford, read his 1929 paper. Florey and a team of scientists, including biochemist Ernst Boris Chain, quickly isolated the effective penicillin compound, conducted successful trials on mice and humans, and began working on the problem of mass-producing penicillin. Their first human subject in 1941 improved dramatically, but later died because there was not enough penicillin to continue the treatment. The team turned to America, where they received help from Merck and Company, various research laboratories, and most of all, a moldy cantaloupe from Peoria, Illinois, whose strain of Penicillium chrysogenum produced 200 times more penicillin than Fleming's source. Mass production started after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, and by 1944, there was enough penicillin to treat all the Allied wounded in World War II. Fleming, Florey, and Chain shared the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1945. Fleming could never have carried his initial discovery to fruition without the team from Oxford. But then again, they never would have had a substance to work on if Fleming hadn't looked at a dirty petri dish in 1928 and said, "That's funny." As for Matthew, after reading Fleming, he returned to his earlier interest in understanding the properties of vampire blood, both its healing, palliative properties, and pathological properties such as blood rage. When he considered it in light of Darwin's theories about evolution and natural selection, Matthew began to reconsider whether blood rage might be a symptom of species progress or species decline. Crick and Watson, The Molecular Structure of Nucleic Acids, Franklin and Gosling, Molecular Configuration in Sodium Thymonucleate, Wilkins, Stokes and Wilson, Molecular Structure of Deoxypentose Nucleic Acids. On April 25, 1953, three articles appeared in the scientific journal Nature that transformed the science of genetics and shaped Matthew's future field of study. The leading article was by Francis Crick and James D. Watson and was entitled The Molecular Structure of Nucleic Acids. The second article that appeared alongside Crick and Watson's was by Rosalind Franklin and Randall Gosling, with the third by another King's College researcher, Morris Wilkins, and his two colleagues. These two articles supported Watson and Crick's findings with their own data. Crick and Watson's article put forward their theory of the double helix structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, the molecule that holds the genetic code of living organisms. Prior to this, scientists had conjectured about the role DNA played in holding and passing on genetic information. They knew it was connected with the structure of the gene, but up until that time, no one had been able to decipher how or why. The correct model was finally laid out by Crick and Watson, who noted in this famous article that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material. DNA was originally isolated in 1869 by a Swiss scientist, Friedrich Miescher. Around the globe, research is built on Miescher's work, with DNA's function in heredity confirmed by the Hershey-Chase experiment in 1952. James Watson, an American molecular biologist, met his British fellow scientist, Francis Crick,